Welcome to the Onyx Pathcast. I'm one of your hosts, Dixie Cochran, here with Eddie Webb.
Hello.
And Matthew Dawkins.
Hello there.
Today it's just the three of us. We're not doing any interviews today, so we're going to have a little bit of a kind of free-form discussion on RPG histories, things that influence our design, ways we like to play, you know, just a little bit of everything. People seem to enjoy the conversational aspect of the first episode, from what we can tell, so we're going to have a conversation, which probably means we're going to, you know, mess with Eddie at some point. It also probably means we're going to talk about wrestling at some point.
That's true.
At least once. I think that's part of our mandate.
And I'm going to try to insert Sailor Moon into there at least one time. So, you know, just doing our thing. So, anyway, Eddie, since, you know, you're the senior of the three of us.
The old man in the mountain.
Yeah, obviously. I didn't know if you want to talk a little bit about, like, we talked a little bit in the last episode about what got us into gaming and our, like, first role-playing experiences, mm-hmm. but what games overall do you think kind of influenced you to get into the industry, or that you played when you were younger? Where'd you come from?
Yeah, so, like I said, I did talk about how I got in. So, after we were playing Marvel Super Heroes to kind of duck under the hazily understood satanic panic. I got into late high school and then college. And during that kind of late 80s, early 90s time, I was kind of naturally drawn towards quote unquote darker games. Because paradoxically, I had gotten D&D and did not find it nearly as corruptive as I had been hoping it would be.
I had that problem too when I first played D&D. I was like, what are they talking about? This is very wholesome.
Yeah, exactly. I don't even understand what the problem is here. I was a big fan of science fiction, and I had just been starting getting into the then nascent cyberpunk movements. I've been reading William Gibson, Walter John Williams, and so Cyberpunk 2020 in particular really resonated with me. And that was probably one of the most initial inspirations, whereas D&D and Marvel Super Heroes were like, these are fun games I enjoy. Cyberpunk was kind of the first one where I was like, maybe I could do something like this. Because it really struck to me the attempts to marry a literary genre with tabletop gaming. And as a side note, kind of anecdotally, Mike Pondsmith, who was the original designer and writer for Cyberpunk 2020, recently reached out to me on Facebook. He's a big fan of Pugmire and really wants me to get the cat book out so his wife can play.
And that is the only reason, behind Monarchies of Mao.
Right, yeah, exactly. It's all just for Mike Pondsmith.
Yeah. You're like, well, I wasn't going to write it, but now I've got to.
Right, yeah. You're all on to me. It's all part of my elaborate plan to infiltrate the industry.
When is Cyber Pugmire coming out?
Cyber Pugmire? That's what I want
to know. Well, that's a nice contraction.
Actually,
I've not heard
it works.
Cyber Pugmire before.
Cyber Pug 2020. Yeah. You got it.
Well, apparently, if I'm going to do that, I have to write it in 2 years to hit my 2020 date. So,
Cyberpunk 3020.
It's more generous deadline.
So, 3020. It's like, yeah, I guess be like, you know, 1,000 years to write it. I should be roughly on time.
Yeah, you'll be fine.
that led me into World of Darkness and specifically Vampire the Masquerade. And one thing that's interesting to me is not a lot of people have played first edition Vampire the Masquerade. A lot of people played second edition because it came out like 1 year after first edition. And so a lot of people, their perspective, their nostalgia for Vampire the Masquerade comes from that edition specifically.
Right.
And especially when we're doing the 20th anniversary edition, we were talking to a lot of people about their nostalgia, their points, their aesthetic, and to many people, second edition was that kind of touchstone. But I actually started on first edition, which is a slightly different beast, actually, and partially it's because of the environment I was coming out in. The idea of playing the monster was still a new concept,
right?
Even though the Nightlife game came out like about like 6 months beforehand, so there is another game that came out ahead of time, but the Nightlife game was not great, sadly. Even though it was Monsters plus Cyberpunk, it should have been my jam, but it just wasn't. But with the first issue, it's much more about the transition, the things you go through when you first become a vampire. So a lot of words spent on what the beast, the struggle, what happens to your friends and families and loved ones when this change happens to you. So it's interesting because my kind of understanding of Vampire the Masquerade comes from that very kind of initially. And also, it had a bit more of the punk aesthetic that fell away later, because it was, I found out many years later talking with Rich Thomas, because it was actual paste up. So people would actually, you know, take the art pieces and paste it onto a sheet that then got sent to the printer. Mm-hmm. So while it was very clean and elegant, it still had that kind of DIY zine aesthetic that was very prevalent in the punk scene, as opposed to, like, say, early Microsoft layout or PageMaker.
Right. I think that's one of the things that drew me to it, actually, was just the art. I mean, the first time that I opened a Vampire the Masquerade book and was looking through the artwork, I was like, this is what I want. This is the way I like to dress already. This is, you mm-hmm. know, these look like my friends if they were vampires.
Absolutely. And you had the kind of the very strong black and white look. And again, you know, the alternative scenes. So there's a lot of overlap with music anyway.
Right.
So it definitely, that kind of initial, these are people I see around me in the subculture, very much lent it to that kind of punk aesthetic, whereas later editions, I think correctly, tried to kind of expand that definition a bit more, bring, you know, slightly more anachronistic characters in, change how they approach things, widen the definitions to bring more people in. I think that was right. But that first very kind of edition really resonated with me specifically. So it's interesting that my kind of gut instincts for Vampire the Masquerade come from a very tiny slice of the 25-year history. But then from there, a lot of my... So, I mean, the initial kind of... I got in the industry was late 80s, early 90s. The rest of the 90s was much more just exploring widely. I got hooked on Over the Edge, which is a game by Jonathan Tweet at Atlas Games, another kind of very surreal modern-day horror game. An obscure little game called Nexus, The Infinite City, which you can't find anymore, but it was very much a, all these worlds intersect in one place. I played a little bit of Cult. So that kind of 90s, it wasn't quite codified as indie, but probably what we'd call it today, scene was very much where a lot of my gaming interests lie until I became a professional in the early 2000s. And so once you make that switch into making games, I think we all still love games. We still love playing them, but you have a different relationship with them.
Right. Well yeah, because like once you kind of see how the sausage is made, that's something that you end up thinking about when you're looking at any game.
Right.
Like every game that I look at now, like there's some part of me that's like, oh, this was an interesting layout choice. You know, this was a really cool mechanic I wouldn't have thought of. And it's like, oh, it's not how I played at all when I was younger. When I was younger, I was just like, these are the rules. I shall follow these rules. Somebody much smarter than me made these.
Wasn't it strange, and maybe I'm just speaking for myself here, I remember when I got a hold of Dungeons & Dragons the first time, and the Player's Handbook, by any standard, is a pretty dry read. It's there's a hell of a lot of tables, a lot of stats. And there's some nice... it's well written around it. Certainly, it generally has to be, because it's D&D. But it's... by no means flavorful. They quite often leave that for a campaign setting to follow.
Right.
And yet, I could read those tables quite happily from first level to 20th level. I could tell you all of the feats that I would have got if I was playing a ranger in 3rd edition Dungeons & Dragons or something like that. And yet, if I read a rule book now, and maybe this is just a symptom of being an old git, I will have to make crib notes for myself to remember the rules. So whether that is down to the strength of the design and layout of a game like D&D, and I say, in fact, it's the same for D&D 5, that is a game that is very easy to understand once you've given it a single read. You've got D&D, at least in my experience and the experience of a lot of people I know, whereas there are other games that do require more than a single read through. You have to make your own notes. You almost have to play through it at a demo level once to find, okay, so that's how combat works. And I guess that highlights something of a flaw in design, if that's the case, because you want games that are immediately accessible. And I recall when I first got into gaming, everyone now knows my Hercules and Xena journey, which of course has never ended. I still wish I was Kevin Sorbo.
Don't we all?
Yeah.
No. Have you seen anything? He's a weird dude, man.
He is. A weird dude. And if you're listening to this, Kevin, we love you and would love to have you on as a guest.
That said, I'd rather be Lucy Lawless, just so you know.
I would rather be Lucy Lawless. But anyway, most of my initial games were pretty traditional, aside from Hercules and Xena, because the main game I played was Dungeons & Dragons, as it was for many people. Moved on to games like Vampire the Masquerade, played Shadowrun, played a bit of Spycraft, and before that, Top Secret, because we had someone at our club yes. who consistently ran Top Secret very badly. Hello, Keith. And I have no contact with these people. Anyone who listens to this who's at all familiar with my YouTube channel may remember the name Keith from a video I made about a Shadowrun game I played, which was one of the worst RPGs I've ever played, and I've played worse. And that's not to say Shadowrun's a bad RPG. Clearly it isn't, because it's still going. But that session was god awful, and maybe that will be a subject for a podcast down the line. But I never played sort of very small press indie games, stapled together pamphlet kind of stuff, until I started going to conventions. And at that point, I started meeting gamers outside of my natural circles who had found games online. And this was really still before the internet had taken over the world. So these were people who were finding indie games in Usenet groups, printing them off, stapling them together themselves, or they were their games of their own design. And I was getting to play those at conventions as one-shots and thinking, oh, okay, this is a different style. And again, speaking of accessibility, quite often those games were, by design, immediately accessible. The systems had to be remarkably simple for you to just run one shot at a convention and never have to run it again. And it's interesting to see how much that little part of the industry has grown to become its own giant, in a sense, with games like Monster Hearts. Like over in the UK, a fairly popular one on the convention circuit is Jaws of the Six Serpents. There's the Comics Code and things like that. These are all indie games that tend to be published out of someone's house or at very low cost, but they're excellent in their accessibility.
I like Dread and Fiasco and stuff for that too. Those are really great, super easy games, really easy to run. You know, character creation for Dread is answer some questions about your character.
Well, but kind of looping back a little bit, you're talking before about how earlier in your life you would kind of memorize and really dig into these books. One thing I think we forget is how we consume games has changed pretty significantly in the past 30 years. On the video game side, I've had talks with some fellow game designers, and one of the things that comes up a lot is why Nintendo games are just so hard. And part of the reason was that we didn't have Steam. We didn't have this idea where you would own hundreds of games realistically. You would have maybe three or four games potentially ever.
You wanted to get play value out of them.
Right, exactly. And so the difficulty did add value to it. And I think a lot of original RPGs were similar unintentionally, perhaps. But they, you know, it's like you had the three hardcover AD&D books, say, and that was probably one of the few games you owned.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you read it over and over again. You really started to master all of that material because you wanted to get as much value out of this single product you had. And then it was kind of in the 90s, in my experience, where there's more of a proliferation. You would own a few dozen games, and that was much more common. And now it's, especially with PDF, sometimes you have hundreds of games. And so when you're working in a much more crowded, not only marketplace, but also much more crowded bookshelf,
right?
Those games need to be much more, I could pick this up and learn it and play it. And I think board games and card games and video games have all kind of gone through the same evolution. Board and card games need to have much more startup. They're much more kind of, I'm going to look up, put up on YouTube a 5-minute how to play my game so people can just watch the YouTube video while we're setting up the components. Video games obviously have much more hand-holding tutorials because they want to get you through the learning curve to get to the actual gameplay as fast as possible. So some of that is not just you getting old and feeble and senile, Matthew. Some of it is...
Oh, thank heavens. Don't
get me wrong, there's still that too. But yes. In addition... some of it is also just how we consume games has pretty significantly changed.
That's a very interesting perspective, and I hadn't considered it. And you know, when you talk about how we would pore over the same books over and over again, I think of how I used to do that with Vampire. And at a certain point, I remember, here's a personal thing. I had an ex-girlfriend who. Well, I had a girlfriend at the time. She's ex now. But
one would hope your wife would be very upset otherwise.
Probably, yeah. I think I probably read Vampire so much. I remember she said something along the lines of, remember, well, Vampire is your hobby. It's not mine. Or you seem to know more about that game than you know about me. And I thought, oh, well, actually, you're probably right, I do. And it was at the point that I could name all of the Antediluvians, including the names that they went by in the first edition Vampire the Masquerade book, as alluded to, that I thought, maybe I know Vampire a little too well, and Forgotten Realms a little too well, and Planescape a little too well. And I thought, this knowledge is utterly useless. Why have I spent years reading these books over and over again? Because it isn't even like I get to run Vampire regularly, because the group I was with at the time hated horror games. So I was reading them more for my own enjoyment. And then, of course, eventually I ended up getting this job, and I'm now working on V5 and worked on Beckett's Jihad Diary, where all of a sudden all of that information I had accrued 10, 15 years prior has suddenly become useful. I became qualified for a job 15 years before I got it. And that's an interesting turn of events.
Well, that's something that I find really interesting, actually, is that we have very different experiences as far as that goes, because I've got a lot of my friends and a lot of my colleagues now that are like, oh yeah, I read these books cover to cover over and over again. I would do anything to get out of having to read a role-playing game book when I started playing. Like, I would read whatever sections were pertinent to character creation and pertinent to the character I was creating.
Oh, so, that, you know, that frustrates me. That frustrates me, Dixie.
I just wanted to play the game.
Sorry to interrupt, but it really pisses me off. If I'm playing in a game and the GM has really hyped it up to say, I'm going to be running this, I want you to come up with fantastic characters, I'm going to tie their stories into the game, blah, blah, blah. And this is me being a little elitist, but if I know a little about the game, and then we start playing it, and it turns out they've not read half the rules, I think, well, that was a waste of time, wasn't it, coming up with that character, because now we're going to spend half the time flipping backwards and forwards through the book, breaking the flow of my story.
For what it's worth, I'm better about it now. This was high school.
Well, so
but but I don't think that I actually read an entire role-playing game book, you know, cover to cover, until I started doing this job, and that's what I do now for work. I read them cover to cover. And I'm so used to it now that I think it wouldn't be a big deal if I had to, you know, start a new game and wanted to read one cover to cover. But I also had a lot of, you know, DMs and storytellers and stuff back in the day who didn't really care if you knew the rules. They would just be like, roll a d20, right, and you would tell them what you got, and they would say, oh, yeah, okay, you succeed. Like, I didn't understand, you know, the difficulty I was rolling against or anything like that, because they just didn't care if I knew or not. And I think a lot of us that were in that group were the same way, so.
Well, again, I think some of this is a bit of an evolution. I mean, if you look at early tabletop designs, there was literally, here's a player's book. It's maybe 64 pages. The fact of a player being that cover to cover is much more appreciable, mm-hmm, than here's even, you know, a Pugmire. I mean, it's not a huge game, but still, it's 256 pages. Reading that cover to cover is a bit more of a daunting task. And that's a quote unquote small game,
right?
From modern perspectives.
It's an interesting.
So, I mean, it is.
I was going to say, it's an interesting thing we never really point out in our games, and maybe this is something we should do. That if I was playing Pugmire and let's say I was playing a shepherd, the only parts I really need to read are the parts about the shepherd. Right. Now, we obviously don't want to put people off reading the whole thing, but we never really signpost that. And I don't know many companies that do, that say, hey, if you want to play a mage, just read this and you're golden. Hmm.
That is an interesting point, actually.
Hmm. See, but we've also, all gone quietly
people that do that.
Well, I mean, I know at least for Pugmire specifically, I did kind of break the book up into here's the player section, here's the guide section, here's the adventure.
Also, you've got really great little call-out notes throughout the whole thing with the two characters going like, hey, read this, this is important.
And that's fair. I mean, that's one of the reasons why I did that, was because to kind of, again, not as much signposting as you're talking about, Matthew, but it was a little bit of, here's an important point. Here's how we do this in a way that doesn't involve boring sidebars, you know. But I think it's another really interesting point is tabletop role-playing games are really a synthesis of prose fiction, because they're almost always fiction, and textbooks.
Mm-hmm.
And they're kind of designed to work both ways simultaneously, which is actually a very tricky thing to accomplish well. To have something that is both fun to read from start to finish and also acts as a good reference guide at the table is actually a difficult set of skills, which is why sometimes when we kind of, if we're not thinking about it from a design perspective, we're kind of just like, oh, this book's kind of hard to read, or I wasn't really into this book, or it kind of bored me. And that becomes then an admonishment of the game itself. I think some of that is a mismatch of too much flavor or not enough flavor, or too much reference, not enough reference design.
Well, okay. Right. So I'm going to throw in an unexpected curveball at this point, both of you, with
uh-oh,
both hands.
Oh, no.
And speaking of games and how readable, how accessible they are, and in the interest of promoting Onyx Path to at least a limited degree, and starting with you, Dixie, because I'm feeling kind to you. Which of our games would you say, given that you have to read them from cover to cover, is the most mm-hmm. accessible? If unlikely as it is, if you were brand new to role-playing and you tuned into this podcast and you wanted a book that you could just pick up and read and you would know exactly what's going on without being bewildered mm-hmm. by arcane terms, which do you think you would recommend?
Especially if we're talking somebody who's brand new to role-playing, mm-hmm. just kind of wants to read a book that's fun, Pugmire or Monarchies, hands down.
Yay.
They're written to be accessible by a large age range, which is nice. So there's not a whole lot of like weird arcane terms. And since it's simplified D&D 5 rules, it's not a whole lot of crunchy mechanics. The mechanics are pretty easy to understand. They make sense. There are the fun little flavor things and characters that kind of go throughout both books that talk to you while you're playing, which I think is fun too. And if you were going with a Chronicles or World book, I would say honestly just a straight up Chronicles of Darkness 2nd Edition, because that is written to kind of be a toolbox for the rest of the games. And also because you're playing, you know, humans doing ghost stories and stuff in that for the most part. It's not, you're a demon and here are all your demon powers, and you're a mummy and here are your mummy powers, and here's all this stuff you have to learn about the background. Like, no, you're a person. And then there's creepy stuff happening. I think most people who have ever watched, you know, Buffy or Supernatural or whatever could pick up that game and play something that made sense to them.
So I'll posit the question to Eddie as well, but with a slight variation. This person has been into role-playing for the last 20 years, has never heard of Onyx Path, and really wants a gripping setting, subjective as it is. And you need to sell them on something that you think will just grab them and make them want to read the book from cover to cover. Of the products we've released in the last 5 years, which do you think you would go for?
I'm going to opt out of the stuff I've worked on directly just because I think it's a little unfair.
That's pretty much everything, Eddie.
Okay, that's fair. But I mean the stuff, like, I'm stepping away from Pugmire specifically just because I don't think it's quite doing what you're looking for, because it's Pugmire specifically kind of intentionally a bit light of the setting. It's much more of the getting stuff in. That said, I think actually Vampire the Requiem does a fantastic job of this. Because it's organized in a way that's very much, step one is, you are a vampire. Here's the cool kinds of vampires you could play. And then it starts to bring you into the world from the core conceit outwards. A lot of various products, including Vampire the Masquerade, says, here's the whole context of being a vampire, and now you can start making a character. One of the things I think Rose did very well for a second edition was to kind of say, you're a vampire. The book's cover says you're a vampire. Here are the vampires. Cool. Now that you know what a vampire is, here's what that all means in context. Here's some cool bits you can do. And then it very naturally draws you from the creature you're playing. Here's the types of creatures you can play. Here's what their society looks like. Now here's their powers and which cool things you can do with those things inside that society. And here's the stuff that the storyteller can do to kind of give you things. It's a natural kind of through line,
right?
That was organized very, very well.
Yeah, no, totally. I can see that in Requiem, definitely. And then all the clan books for Requiem are absolutely beautiful as well,
definitely.
And give you a lot of really cool information, but also a lot of great fiction. And actually, I read Beckett's Jihad Diary because I edited that, and as someone who did not obsessively read vampire books when I was younger, aside from a lot of the fiction, that was really cool and accessible. I felt like I knew what was going on, even if there were characters I wasn't as familiar with.
That's high praise indeed. Thank you very much.
Yeah, I'm not just doing that to make you feel good about yourself. I feel weird that I just like mentioned an Eddie book and a Matthew book. So,
know, that's the reason we're doing the podcast. We're only here to tell each other how fantastic we are. No, you know what? With Beckett's Jihad Diary, and it's time for shameless self-promotion. Some of the feedback, well, all of the feedback I've got on it, to be honest, I don't know of one person yet who has fed back to say this book is inaccessible. And that was my biggest fear with Beckett's Jihad Diary, because by its nature, it is a book that is crammed to the gills with metaplot. It is about the depths and lengths of Vampire the Masquerade in a world that's been built over the last 25 years. And despite that, people are able to open it up, find a story hook or a page or a character or something like that and follow them through it and find it interesting, whether
right.
as
yeah.
just a story or as inspiration to run chronicles. And that's obviously what we wanted from it. But I did have the fear when we were coming to release it, is this too deep and mysterious? You know, are the references in this book far too obscure for anyone to really appreciate? And I think there's a nice balance of stuff that does act as Easter eggs to the long-term fans of Vampire. And mm-hmm. you know, I've spoken to a lot of people who have said their favourite thing to do with Beckett's Jihad Diary is they have it open either in print or in a separate tab as PDF, and they have the White Wolf Wiki open in a separate tab. So when they come across terms or characters they don't know about, they will look them up at that point. They will stop and they will reference as if it's a new sort of Encyclopedia Vampirica, to the point that I believe one person is even adding White Wolf wiki entries as they go along through Beckett's Jihad diary. So later on, you know, it in theory, it's a book that will grow in its giving ability, because in a year's time, someone who's coming to it for the first time will find all these Wikipedia entries that someone else has made based on Beckett's Jihad diary, and that's very pleasing to me. But I'm going to go against the grain a little before I pass over about accessibility and interesting nature of setting. I'm going to name a book that I don't think many people would expect, and that's Mage, the Ascension 20th Anniversary Edition. And next to some of our books, which certainly seem more accessible, whether through weight alone, Mage doesn't appear to be an accessible book because of its size. And I think certainly it's drawn a fair amount of attention because of that. So that feature alone, it is a massive book and contains a massive amount of information. But the interesting thing is the 20th anniversary editions have been through a sort of iterative process. V20 was, for all intents and purposes, a compendium and celebration, but it didn't move anything forward until the source books, or didn't expand anything until the source books came out. When we got Werewolf 20, we were a little more bold with that. And some of the ideas with Werewolf 20, modernizing it, expanding it a little within the core book, introducing the changing breeds within the core book and so on, made that book feel like an upgrade to V20. And then you have Mage 20, which is divided into different books within the book. So you essentially have your book for Sleepwalkers and your book for Awaken and your book for Technocracy and this and that and the other. And on the subject of if you want to pick up a book and just find the sections that are specifically for you, as whether it's a player or a storyteller who wants to focus on this single part of the game, Mage 20 is brilliant for that. I've only found this out recently because I've started working on Mage 20, but myself and the players that I play with and playtest with have all been looking through Mage 20 and have all found it remarkably accessible for what they want. We all agree that if you were to read it from beginning to end, you'd probably go blind. But if you have your specific intention in mind, so I want to play a Chronicle set here, and I want these traditions to be accessible, and I want it to be a focus on this part of the mythos, it's all there in the book. You just shouldn't sort of get blinded by everything around it. And that means next time, if you want to play a Technocracy game where you have a member of Iteration X and a member of the Syndicates, and they're trying to do this and that, that's all in there as well. You just don't read the words around them. And so Mage is a game that is ostensibly inaccessible, but I think if you give it the time, you can find a lot of excellent information in there.
It is an interesting take that is definitely probably the last book I thought you were going to say, just because so many people look at it and they go, how many pages? 700? What? I've got at least one friend who calls it his home defense book, because, you know, that's what he's going to grab if he ever has to smack a burglar.
Well, yeah.
And also, a bullet will probably not make it all the way through.
But yeah, no, that's, I mean, it is a well-laid out book. Like, it's large and terrifying to a lot of people. But once you do dig into it, like, because, like you said, of the separation and the way it's laid out, I can definitely see that being one that, if nothing else, it's fun to go through, you know?
Well, like, I think
through role-playing game books.
It appeals to me on the same level as Beckett's Jihad Diary does, because while Beckett's Jihad Diary has more of a linear narrative, it's not strictly linear, but it's certainly a narrative, it's a book you don't need to read all of in one gulp, and you don't need to read it from chapter one to chapter, however many chapters there are, to enjoy it. And I think Mage is stronger in that regard than V20 and Werewolf 20. And don't get me wrong, I love Vampire and Werewolf, but in terms of aesthetic, layout, accessibility, and so on, I think Mage 20 may even, for me, trump Changeling and Wraith 20th anniversary editions. So there you go. There's a revelation for this episode.
Ooh.
Mm.
Revelatory.
We don't have a game where you have a meter of revelations, do you? Do we? That sounds like the sort of terminology we should be using. Eddie, let's put it in Contagion Chronicle.
No.
We need
to finish
a new
that
step.
Book.
We're doing very well with Contagion Chronicle. As we're
talking,
I think we are planning during this podcast to talk about some of our current projects, some of the ones on backer kits, and Dixie is the mastermind when it comes to that kind of thing. But
we can move right into that if you want to talk about Contagion.
Yeah. Well, I'll just keep nattering on.
Like, could stop you.
Yeah, no one's yet found a way yet.
I'm pretty sure Eddie can kick you out of the recording.
That's true, I can. We found that out, actually.
Oh, that was intentional. Okay. Well, it all becomes clear now. Okay. So the reason
I would never say to your face that was intentional.
Yeah, the reason I wasn't in the last interview wasn't by choice. I was there. I was screaming, "Please let me in! I want to be a part of this." And they said, "No, you've spoken up on the first episode. I won't be in the next interview either. There's a conspiracy against me."
You're too charming. That's the problem.
Well, you're worried. I will dominate the share of listeners. They will all say, "We want more Matthew."
If they're American listeners, yeah, they got the whole accent thing.
Sure.
Yeah, and there aren't many nations that say we want more Americans.
Well, America does, but that's about
yes,
it.
Yeah, well, parts of America anyway. But yeah.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
Oh no, politics on my podcast. No.
So yeah, Contagion Chronicle. So as of time of recording, we are entering final draft stage. Redlined documents have started going back to writers as we speak, and it's quite an interesting project, this one, because we discussed it in brief on the first episode, and we won't spend a lengthy amount of time on it this time. But one of the things we found is, as mentioned in the first episode, we have our five ostensibly playable factions, the Sworn, and we have our three antagonistic factions, the False. But as written, all of them can be played. Your character is just probably more of a dick if he's in the False, I think is probably fair. And that's just due to their philosophies. They aren't the get along with your brothers kind of factions. They are the kind of groups that will happily screw over the world to survive a little longer or climb up the ladder a little faster. They will tread on the face of the person below them. So during first drafts on Contagion Chronicle, we focused entirely in terms of the vectors, which are our powers, on the Sworn, and said, well, the False aren't supposed to be the focus out of the gate here. The Sworn are. So let's focus entirely on their power set. They will be your playable options. And by some small miracle, we have ended up with more word count than we expected after Redlines.
You're welcome.
Yeah, that's it. That's Eddie, because he just thought, I'll just write one sentence for this and half a word for that and see whether it can get past. And it did.
Minimum effort.
Yeah, I love that. We call it lean working. What it actually means is I can't be bothered to sit at my computer for longer than 5 minutes. And so we ended up with words left. And I just recently, again, as of time of recording, had a word with Eddie and our other two writers on the vectors and said, well, how do we feel about writing the vectors up for the False as well? And everyone was like, yeah, you know, we'll use these extra words. And because they don't have as many words as the Sworn, we've got to rethink the way they're going to be using their vectors. They can't use them in the exact same way. And rather than that being a source of frustration and making us think, ah, crap, we've got to go back to the drawing board, it's an interesting new challenge, because now we've got to think, okay, so if you're false, what does that mean mechanically, other than the fact that you're not going to be working with the swarm? What does that mean for your vectors? Because in theory, they are the same sorts of powers. They are you interacting with your companions of various splats, your vampires working with your Prometheans and your mummies, but in a way that potentially weaponizes contagion or benefits you to the detriment of everyone else. And so we've spoken about sort of the Athas Dark Sun magic, that way of enriching yourself at severe penalty to the world around you, and right. helping contagion grow, but obviously giving yourself massive buffs at the same time, because you don't care, you just want to be king. So that's where we are with contagion right now. We, of course, have lots of other chapters, but it's been quite an interesting couple of days coming to that conclusion that, okay, we've got these extra words, let's not waste them. Let's put them into something that alternative groups might want to play around with, because inevitably there are going to be players who want to play as the pure, and there'll be players who want to play as reapers, and or may even want to use huntsmen in a more playable capacity. And now Contagion Chronicle will support that, which is quite a pleasing outcome.
I think it's interesting that you pretty much, it sounds like you're making it so you can play, you know, a super antagonist in a game where you all, like, all of our game lines, you already kind of play the bad guys, as far as the Chronicles games.
Yeah.
So it's kind of fun that you're like, here, these guys are extra bad. They're bad to the bad guys.
Well, you know, there are always going to be certain limitations, because the core books for every single line are never going to go into as much detail about playing the Strix, let's say, as playing a Daver in the Invictus, because that's not what Vampire the Requiem is built for. But there are plenty of groups that do play around with that, who love playing the evil party, to use D&D sense. So with that in mind, why not provide the tools for players to do the exact same thing with Chronicles of Darkness? We just don't have the word count or time to dedicate to every single antagonistic faction in length or depth. But if the tools are there, the storytellers and players who want to explore that can go on to use them. And that's not to say that the false factions don't contain Daver and the Invictus and Forsaken Werewolves and Mages on the Silver Ladder and so on. You know, they're all still potentially false, but you've also got your big bad Gribblies in there as well.
Right. Yeah, that's really, really cool, actually. So that's going into final draft right now, you said?
Yep. I'm drip feeding the red lines back to writers, but all of the drafts are very there's always going to be some fixes required, and that's why we do red lines. But and that's why we don't load that all on the editor, because that would be an awful job.
It'd be very sad.
But as a whole, this book is coming together very cleanly.
Awesome, that's what I like to hear.
Yeah, makes my life a lot easier.
Yeah, that's what I'm noticing about some of the Exalted projects right now, is everything just seems to be kind of sinking. And it's making me very happy, like, the way things are just kind of falling into place. Because, I mean, we just wrapped up the Dragonblooded Kickstarter, and now we're actually working on Lunars, and then, of course, the stretch goals from the Dragonblooded Kickstarter. I say we, because it's, you know, the project under my purview, but mostly it's Eric Minton and Robert Vance and their crew. Right. I'm just watching them do it and going, like, hey, this looks good. But, yeah, it's really nice to be kind of, like, streamline pumping out some Exalted work, because it gives us room if we do, you know, have to wait on something for a little while, or if anything does go wrong or a writer drops or whatever. But it's happening, and it's happening in a streamlined way now, and it's great.
And that, honestly, I mean, that's one of the things that I think is good about this new approach we're taking on with the three of us, is that one thing I think people don't tend to think about when they think about Onyx Path is that we do make a lot of products. A lot of people get kind of a little more focused on, hey, I'm a fan of the World Darkness, I'm a fan of this, I'm a fan of that.
Right.
So they tend to get more involved in the things that they enjoy about it. But yeah, in an aggregate, we make a lot of products, and so being able to kind of work with the teams a little bit more, and say I could spend time digging in deeper, like to Scion or Trinity or Dystopia Rising or whatever. You can dig in deeper and kind of help out the Exalted crew a bit more.
Yeah.
And so that I think it really helps, because it does get things a little more streamlined, a little more out there. It's still a lot of books to make, and sometimes it's going to be issues and collisions, and things are going to run late, and things are going to take longer, or things are going to snap, and sometimes work really well and get out a little early sometimes. I mean, yeah, that occasionally happens too.
I like early. Early is nice.
Well, that's the plan, hopefully, with Shunned by the Moon for Werewolf of Forsaken. I mean, you know, I'm tempting fate by saying it here.
Yeah, why would you say that?
But I know. I'm going to be raked over the coals now. Rich, if you're listening to this, I'm sorry. I didn't give an exact date. This is the second time I've done this now. I at least didn't say it would be out, you know, before Gen Con. But it definitely will know.
definitely I will won't have, is what you're going to say.
Yeah, yes, I will have a proofed copy in my hand at Gen Con. I'm sure Mike would love to rally the artists just for a Night Horrors book. Why not? But no, my intention with that book is I've got writers essentially blitzing it. They're working to high quality. They're going to go through the exact same steps as every other set of writers on a book. But a lot of them know the subject matter incredibly well. Mm-hmm. I'm pulling on the writer's experience too, because we have Chris Allen, we have Leith Shields, both of them, and Joyce Chung, and all three of them, I should say, know Werewolf the Forsaken incredibly well. And we have Ethan Skemp, which maybe should have put him at the front of the list. But he's obviously fairly synonymous with Werewolf. Some people might associate him with that brand. So, and there's a whole pool of other writers too who I'm doing a great disservice to by not mentioning. But the reason I mention those four is because they all know Werewolf incredibly well. And I can trust them to put together a solid book, which means that the parts that are being written by new writers are the parts I really need to focus on as developer. And that's a style I'm coming to enjoy. Mix it up with experienced or established writers and brand new writers.
Yeah,
because
definitely.
You can then set up mentor relationships between new writers and established writers, or you can have meetings where the developer doesn't have to lead the meeting. You can have one of your lead writers do so and benefit from their years of experience and knowledge of the game.
Right.
So, you know, the hope is that will make Shunned by the Moon a nice, quick turnaround, at least in the writing stakes. It all will fall down in editing, I know, Dixie, but that's your fault.
Yep,
I'm just passing the buck. Don't worry. if there are any delays, it will be down to Dixie.
Oh, okay.
Actually, similarly, sometimes that kind of change in dynamic doesn't necessarily add speed, but does add a different texture. Like we're doing something a little similar for Aberrant, where we actually have functionally three developers on the book, which is unusual. Ian Watson's continues to be the kind of creative lead for the entire Trinity continuum. And he's very much the guy that's like, you know, okay, we need to do more of this, less of this. This is where Aberrant fits into the whole game line perspective, the high level view. And here's a bunch of very specific information that I think would be cool, because where Matthew spent his time reading World Darkness books, Ian spent his time reading every Werewolf book.
He
really knows all of them very well.
Gold mine of information.
He really is. He's like, yeah, I've been to know. I'm sure when we have our interview with him, he'll give us all sorts of fascinating information. But then I'm picking up primarily on a much more of a producer level, just making sure that contracts are done and everything's pulled together, make sure people hit their deadlines, basically just making the project go. Whereas Steve Kenson is much more explicitly the lead designer, lead writer. He's writing 53,000 words of the book, which is about a third of it, just by himself. But also he put together the outline. He's communicating with the writers, reaching out to them, making sure they have the information they need. He's very much the creative vision for the book. And it's a new way for us of making products that does kind of emulate more of the TV model. Mm-hmm. Of one side's producer, one side's director, or showrunner. The showrunner kind of leads the writing room. That's kind of closer to the model we're doing here. It's a free Steve up to just focus on the creative side of things, and I can be the guy that comes in and says, "Okay, cool, this is all great. When's my manuscript showing up?" and also Steve can say, "What do we do this? We can do that," and I can then combine all those ideas and take them back to the art team or to Rich and say, "What if we do these things? How are we going to go with this, about this?" I don't think it will add a ton of speed to our production. I think it'd be about a year, which is pretty typical for a core book. Mm-hmm. And even though it's part of the Trinity Continuum, we're still treating it like a core book from a design perspective. But it does add a lot more texture. Steve's bringing in a lot more ideas, both from Aberrant as a property, but also his own experience working on every superhero game in the past 10 years. And also really focus and dig into that, while Ian can be thinking about how it fits into the greater picture, and I can think about how this fits into our release schedule. So it's an interesting way of doing things, and I'm curious to see how it pans out. But it's again, as we each project, we can kind of try these different models and go, okay, what does this product need? In this case, Shun by the Moon, let's see if we can do a high quality product in a short period of time. In mm-hmm. Aberrant's case, like, can we bring a lot of degree of texture and information while not slowing down the release schedule? You know, with Exalted, like you're saying, is like, you know, can you reframe and restructure what the Exalted team needs so that way they can get things out in a steadier cadence?
Right. Yeah. We're
all these different ways of kind of approaching products.
We've definitely been talking about getting some more new writers on the Exalted team in general, simply mm-hmm. because, like, for the same reason, because once Lunars was assigned, which just happened, they just went into first drafts, they all kind of went like, well, that's all of our writers pretty much. And I'm like, okay, well, then we need more, because we're going to be working right on more than one book at one time, because this is a huge line and we have Kickstarter goals and whatever. So that's something that we're looking into, as well as trying to make sure that books are coming out kind of in tandem or being worked on in tandem, as opposed to, you know, in a very linear fashion, like one book, then one book, then one book, which I think is something else that's helpful having the three of us here. Because when our job was kind of all done by one person, I know that had to be, I can't imagine.
Yeah, it's just exhausting. I mean, the stuff that I know we all do, and it's just like, Rose basically did three people's jobs, it seems.
Yeah.
Because all of our stuff is basically a whole job.
And I mean, kind of four, because she was doing some stuff that we've handed off to Val as well.
That's true, yeah, all so the translation
like,
stuff.
It's like, man, how did you do this? Like, I don't understand. So speaking of Trinity and some of our other projects that we're working on and Kickstarters and the like, I want to talk a little bit about BackerKit, because I think some people don't know about it. And that makes me sad.
Still talk about it.
Please do.
So, as most people know, if you're just picking up this podcast and have no idea who we are, then congratulations for getting through the last 53 minutes. Because we probably said a lot of stuff that made no sense to you. But we do...
I'm sure it's still very interesting and, you know, captivating.
You sound very sincere right now, Matthew. Very sincere.
Well... Well, you know, if they've made it through the last 53 minutes, either they are captivated or
captive.
They've they're captive or they've broken their femur and they're laying on the floor and they can't get away from the computer. And they're thinking, why is this playing? I never selected the Onyx podcast. So anyway, sorry to go back to the BackerKit now, and I'll just shut
anyway.
Up.
Anyway, so. A lot of our big projects, our core books, things like that, we do, or like big splat books, we do via Kickstarter. We've done, I think, 29 now? 29th Kickstarter?
Somewhere around there,
yeah. Blooded? Yeah. So we've done 29,
wow.
Which is super cool. But there's a cool thing where after the Kickstarter is over, I know a lot of people get sad when they miss Kickstarters, or maybe they don't have the, you know, cash at the time, but then they get it a couple months later. If you go to the page for a lot of our Kickstarters, you can still pre-order this stuff through a service called BackerKit. I'm not going to give BackerKit links straight up because they're actually kind of weird. It's easier just to search for the Kickstarter and then click the big button at the top. But for instance, we were just talking about Trinity, which had a pretty successful Kickstarter. But you can still pre-order all the Trinity core books, the screen, all that stuff for for Aeon and the core through BackerKit, which is really cool. So we've, you know, our Kickstarter was like 180,000+, and so we've done another like 5.6K in BackerKit, which is cool for us, you know, cash wise, but it's also cool for you to get the books. I ended up editing Scion a while back, which, you know, is a little behind, but I went and ordered it because I wanted the really nice copies that you can get through the Kickstarters. And I was like, oh, it hasn't come out yet, so I can actually still order that. And I did just a few days ago. So there are a few other things you can get through there right now besides Trinity and Scion. One of them is one of your projects, Eddie. Because you can still pre-order Monarchies of Mal.
Monarchies of Mal, yeah. And in fact, if I'm remembering correctly, Pugmire was the first project we tried BackerKit on. And that actually worked really well. So we're happy to do it again with Mal. And I know from my perspective, it works out great because when we did the Monarchies of Mal Kickstarter, I put together what I called early access, which is basically it's not quite the final product. Like some of our products, we had the final manuscript and we put that, make that available to backers. Mm-hmm. Because I wanted to have the Kickstarter backers have a little bit of a role in development. Instead, I put together an early access version, which was not the entire manuscript, but it was also much closer to final. It was laid out, there was art there, so something that was very akin to what the final book would look like. But even then, we then put it, after Kickstarter was over, we put it up as a couple of hours on DriveThruRPG, and so lots of people would then stumble across it, spend a couple bucks, go, oh, this is really cool, and then realize they missed a Kickstarter because that was kind of the output of the Kickstarter. So by the fact of having something like BackerKit, then people can, it's still active now. You can go in through it before it gets delivered and sign up for it and get that book sent to you when it's ready to go. So it allows for, we still have the cool event of having the Kickstarter, which I think is very important for a marketing perspective, from a design perspective, from a business perspective. Having that cool event begin and end is important, but there is kind of a tail afterwards of people going, oh crap, I need to get in there and get it now. One thing that I'm actually glad that Onyx Path doesn't do is we don't do a ton of Kickstarter exclusives.
Right.
I know it's a great way to get people to back the Kickstarter, but it makes people feel, it's like, oh, well, I can never get that again. We do a lot of, it's exclusive to you for a time, you know, or it's, you have into the product, or you have a chance to kind of shape the product. That's all stuff I think is really cool and interesting. But anything that the Kickstarter produces within reason will ultimately be available to everyone down the road.
Oh yeah, totally.
And BackerKit's kind of one way to do that, I think.
One of the things that I like too, like for the Monarchies BackerKit, for instance, you can do the core rulebook, you can do the PDF, whatever you want, but you can also still get the Pugmire core book through there, or the Pugmire PDF and dice and things. Like, it's not just the books that we put on BackerKit. It's a lot of the products that we offered as like add-ons and things for the Kickstarter. For instance, the Beckett's Jihad Diary on BackerKit, I think you can still get those really beautiful dice. Yeah. These like gorgeous V20 deluxe dice. You can still get those on there, which is awesome.
I believe so.
It's actually
I'm looking at it right now.
we just sent up the box art to White Wolf to review. So yeah, it's still available.
Right. So that's
That might not be at the time this podcast.
Well, that's true.
True. Okay. You're right. I forgot about
sorry,
that.
Sorry, might have missed that.
In theory.
Yeah. So some of them, I mean, obviously these go away as we ship them and as they actually, like, we start doing the Kickstarter for fulfillment. But if you miss one of our Kickstarters, generally you're going to have a period of at least a few weeks, you know, or a couple months where you can get stuff afterwards.
And also, but again, starting with Pugmire, we've been having some great success in, even after everything's shipped, we're done. By the way, we print stuff. There's usually a number of items left over. Sometimes it's a handful, sometimes it's a couple hundred, depends on how things shake out. And we found some success in then reselling those through companies like Studio 2 or Indie Press Revolution. So even after all that's done, people can still potentially pick up some of the add-ons and cool benefits of Kickstarter. But there's still also, again, that kind of feeling of, if you don't get it, we're probably not going to make it again. You know, for like the Pugmire, it's like, if it sells amazingly in distribution. We make certain the print run, but odds are we're probably just going to have default to the print on demand version. So if you for some reason wanted the print run version, there is a limited time. So there's still, I think, the interesting. It allows us to balance not making products in perpetuity. So we're not like basically doing entire print runs to sell like 3 or 4 a year.
Mm-hmm.
And it allows for people to feel like they got in at the ground floor for cool, interesting products, but it doesn't shunt people into a 30-day window.
Right, exactly, which is what's cool, because I mean, like, I understand, you know, finances. There have been so many Kickstarters over the years that I've been like, I'd love to back that, but I just don't have a spare, you know, $150 this month to get the really cool prestige edition or whatever. And I hear that mm-hmm. all the time from people at conventions when they come to us and they see that we have the deluxe versions on the table and they're like, oh my god, I missed that because I, you know, my car broke down at the time and I couldn't afford it, and now I can. And it's like, oh well, like, cool, we still have it, enjoy.
Yep. But exactly. You know, go to Backer-Kit, Backer's closed, go check out IPR. Yeah.
Yeah. So you have so many options with that, which is cool.
Absolutely. And actually, and I think it's good because as we talk about the ideology of how we approach this stuff, it allows us to, we're constantly evolving. I mean, every Kickstarter, I think we're trying something new, trying to just get better than we did last time. But we're going to be doing soon, we're going to do a Pugmire card game. And I've been talking a lot about Fetch Quest and the fact that we're doing a card game, but that's actually still relatively new to us. We've only ever done Princess Gambit. That's the first card game we did.
Which you can still get on Backer-Kit.
We learned a lot from that one. And so now doing a Pugmire one, again, we have the idea of we can do exclusive cards, you know, like these cards that you get through the Kickstarter.
Mm-hmm.
Do those as add-ons or whatnot. We're still hammering out details, but also being able to send those cards through to like other outlets that you can buy them and eventually put them up as print-on-demand cards that you can then buy through drivethroughcards.com. So that way, again, it's like any time you buy into Fetch Quest, you can get all the content there, but you might not get the nice box that we're doing for the print run of Fetch Quest. You may have to get a print-on-demand deck that's in a clear plastic case or something. You may, you know, get cards that you know, they're just print-on-demand versions, so it's not the one that you should print run that we did.
Mm-hmm.
But we still have access to everything at any point in time. It's just that the closer you get to it, the closer to the process you get, and also, Frankie's bragging rights. It's like, I got this during Kickstarter. That's one thing I hear a lot from fans, is they're genuinely proud of being part of the Kickstarter. It's the, you know, I bought in this product day one. It feels like an investor who invested in Apple in the early 80s kind of thing, you know?
I got in right at
the start.
A lot of our Kickstarters have had very good communities behind them. Obviously we've got our established fans, but the updates and the comments section, the back and forth, being able to vote sometimes on upcoming content for a book has always gone down very well. I mean, there's during votes, it should be noted, there's always going to be some people that are unhappy, but because their choice didn't go through. But despite that, the enthusiasm that's come around because of little activities like that has been wonderful to witness and be a part of. So Beckett's Jihad Diary, we were doing voting for some of the expansion chapters, if you recall. And of course, we did the same thing for Dark Eras. So it'll be interesting to see how we do that kind of thing in future. But you mentioned Fetch Quest, the Pugmire card game. What other Kickstarters do we have coming up this year? What's planned? Can we discuss them?
There's a couple that we can discuss.
In vague terms.
Right. I've obviously already mentioned Aberrants, and I it seems unlikely that we would not kickstart that. We kickstarted, the Trinity Kickstarter was, like I said, $187,000. It was successful.
Mm-hmm.
And Aberrant is even more rabidly loved than Aeon. So I think it's highly likely we'll do a Kickstarter of Aberrant. And we're actually already talking about some potential stretch goals, which I can't go into, but Matthew and I specifically have pitched an idea, for the Aberrant Kickstarter. So we have some ideas for that. And also we have already announced-ish, but Dystopia Rising, I'm working on the Dystopia Rising tabletop role-playing game, and that's almost certainly going to be a Kickstarter. Again, we've talked with Eshton Media. A lot of discussions were framed around the idea of when this goes to Kickstarter, how we're going to do it, and what the structure is going to look like. And I think that's also ripe for a Kickstarter for a few reasons, one of which is it's a new property that we're working on. I think the first time we do a book in a new property is always a good Kickstarter potential because it gets people excited about the overall potential line that property will spawn.
Right.
And also it acts as marketing to a certain extent. You know, hey, this is a cool thing coming out. We think it's good enough that we want you to give us money for it.
Yeah.
Right.
Just even though Dystopia Rising is a horror game, which is a genre that we're intimately familiar with, it's a different style. Post-apocalyptic is a very different style from modern horror, and it brings new flavor, new texture, new context. I've actually been doing some reading of things like sociological studies of how people react in disaster zones.
Mm-hmm.
Figuring out things like how do we handle equipment, because equipment becomes very important now, where it's much more abstract in modern day horror games. So a lot of different things that come with that, and a Kickstarter helps to kind of in one place talk about, here's what's cool about this game, here's what we're doing differently, here's our pedigree to show you that's in good hands. All that stuff makes sense in the context of a Kickstarter campaign that we can then easily point to and say, if you want to learn more about this game, until the book comes out and we have a more traditional marketing platform in place, the Kickstarter is a good repository of information about why we think this game is cool and interesting.
Yeah, definitely. I love Kickstarter for that. I've been really enjoying reading all the comments on Dragon Blooded while that was going on. And then also like getting to compile things into an FAQ, getting to see what people don't like, you know, if there's a thing that's like really weird, it's kind of like, well, maybe we should redo that. Maybe we shouldn't, but it's good information. I know too, we've had such good luck with releasing the manuscripts via Kickstarter. Like I actually really enjoy that because I like seeing people get hyped up about it, you know?
Yeah.
Like you can read the whole book if you want during a lot of our Kickstarters. Maybe not all of them, but that's something that we've been doing recently. And I think it's a really cool kind of, you know, fun thing for the Kickstarter backers, speaking of people liking things that are exclusive.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
So.
You know, that's
and
that's
now we're gonna have an awkward silence.
Yeah, no, that's not awkward. That feels like an appropriate conclusion point, unless we have any other pertinent business for this podcast number 3 in the order. Now that I've announced that, we can't casually insert this somewhere else in the order. This is the 3rd podcast.
You are literally the worst.
Yeah, this is great. We were trying to record a backup episode right now. Hey, Eddie, do you want to kick him out again?
No, I guess other than that, what is there to say regarding other projects we have upcoming? I mean, we mentioned in the first one, They Came From Beneath the Sea, of course, which is playtest is wrapped. Eddie and I have had some very good discussions about things like tone and system, and hopefully that will come through the wash, as it were, editing. Which will be where it's off to in the not too distant future.
Yay, I'm excited to read it.
Good. I hope you enjoy it.
I'm
Obviously, it's your opinion that matters more to me than any of the people that buy the thing. But,
you just blamed me if anything goes wrong with latest on other projects. So.
Yeah, but
he's a very fickle man.
I am, but you know, some projects I attach a very strong connection to you. I think your opinion of They Came From Beneath the Sea will make it sink or swim, ha ha ha. Whereas Shun by the Moon, don't care.
We've also
just cast a paycheck and move on, right?
You've also got Geist Second Edition coming out?
Yes.
So
yeah,
that'll be a thing.
And you know, that game, Geist the Sin Eaters, given it wasn't by any means a magnificent hit when it came out first edition. It was popular, but given the fact that it was only the core book and one expansion, which was a New World of Darkness expansion as well, just Geist, Book of the Dead, it's received a huge amount of engagement on our blog. Whenever the blog posts regarding Geist Second Edition go up, it always numbers in the, 40 through to 60 comments or so engaging on the blog topic, which is wonderful. I love it when a But when a game, when I have to admit, when I heard Geist was being was getting a second edition, I was thinking, okay, this one's not going to be as big as Changeling. There's no way it's going to be as big as Changeling the Lost. But I don't know. It'll be interesting to see, because just from forum and blog engagement alone, there seems to be a lot of interest in the mystery and perhaps the chance to visit it for the first time because it was missed the first time it came out.
Yeah, I think it's got a bit of a cult following, which is super cool. And I also, there are a lot of people who are kind of like, I'm interested to try this, but I really wanted to have second edition rules. I've heard the same thing about, you know, Mummy, where they're like, I kind of want to play this, but it doesn't have, you know, second edition rules. And I was like, okay, well, we're doing what we can.
Well, we've had talks about that, haven't we? About Mummy.
And that's all we can say.
Yeah.
But as far as Exalted goes, I mean, we'll be doing Lunars. Like I said, we're working on that. And I believe that's going to be kickstarted at some point. And then I think most Exalted fans would know what to expect after that without me saying too much. So there is more to come on that front. That's all I can say. Yeah. But it's very exciting stuff.
And we have, in terms of World of Darkness, while I can't say for any certainty that any of these will be kickstarted, there's a few big mage releases that are quite happily ticking along for Mage of the Ascension.
Mm-hmm.
Gods and Monsters, as of time of recording, which is a name change. I think it was Gods, Monsters, and Strange Companions or Other Creatures, but it's now just Gods and Monsters.
Familiar Strangers.
That's Familiar Strangers. I was halfway there. is at a stage now where very soon, with any luck, we'll have it in editing and art direction. So that's good, because that means there's an Ascension book on the horizon. Horizon War, you could say. That's an in-game reference. I won't expect you to understand, it's fine. But there's other... But there are other Mage of the Ascension books as well. There's a nice chain of books coming along, and I'm excited to see where that goes. We may not be done with Werewolf the Apocalypse yet. We can't say for certainty what is going to happen, but I'm in talks with someone about working on something for Werewolf the Apocalypse, and it might be big, so we'll have to see. And of course, there's Book of Oblivion.
These are the vaguest teasers.
Yeah, but you know, that's the kind of teasers. It wouldn't be a teaser if it was.
They're definitely human.
No, they're Garou.
They will probably speak English.
And we have Book of Oblivion for Wraith the Oblivion, which Bruce Bohr and I are co-developing, and we have some fantastic new authors and some fantastic established writers.
He is so excited about that.
Bruce, oh yeah. It's wonderful to see. And yeah. Bruce, if you listen to this, it's wonderful working with you, my friend, because Bruce is something of an old hand in our industry. He's worked on Wraith and a lot. I think he worked on some of the New World of Darkness stuff, didn't he? But I could be wrong.
Yeah.
But either way, he's been with us a long time, on and off. And failing health aside, and I hope you get well soon, this book has really produced a lot of energy from Bruce that's just been incredibly gratifying to see. And it's great fun working with him on this book. So I won't name any of the authors just yet, because it's nice to tease, but we've got some old Wraith hands back in the game. We even have some old Vampire hands back in as well, from way back in the White Wolf days. I would say late 90s. So, and as I say, we've got new as well, so it'll be a nice combination, which I think is appropriate for our 20th anniversary books, to have touch of the old and a touch of the new.
Yeah, I like that we've been doing that both with writers and with like art and art styles and things.
Absolutely.
So you get some new stuff, you get some classic stuff. Maybe start saying classic instead of old.
Classic. Old. So well, classic, that's classic. Am I classic?
Not that
vintage.
Old, Eddie.
Vintage, like a cheese or wine, depending on your preference.
Both.
Yes,
cheesy wine.
Yes, cheesy wine. And now, you know, I thought we'd reached a fantastic conclusion point.
No, I think I think cheesy wine is it. I think.
Yes.
I think we go out on cheesy wine.
Eddie, what is your favorite wine to go with cheese?
I do not have one. I'll have to think about that and get back to you in a future podcast.
Okay. Next podcast, that will be the big question. Your favorite wine to accompany cheese. Of course, you might not be a wine drinker. In that case, I won't hold you to it.
I mean, to be fair, I like wine, but I don't know enough about it to have a strong opinion yet.
You guys realize
beer, I'm different, but not wine with wine.
We're going to do a wine and cheese episode. We have to have Jason Carl on as the guest, right?
Oh, yeah.
Like, he has an entire Instagram called Vampires and Vino.
I'm going to blow his cover here because he doesn't actually drink all of that wine. And we have to be thankful for that. He doesn't drink as much wine as he posts, because if he did, he would be dead. Or pickled.
He posts like a glass every 2 days. He would not be dead.
No. He's told me. So sorry, Jason, your secret's out. He's a teetotaler, never drinks. No, not really.
He's drinking all, actually. He's drinking liquid, period.
Yeah, he doesn't even read. He can't read. He's illiterate.
It's kind of creepy.
Yeah.
He posts
pictures of books and wine because it's some vestigial longing for a life that he wishes he could have. But
I just point out to everybody that may not realize this, that we are all friends with Jason Carl.
Yes, we are.
And are giving him crap as friends. Because otherwise this sounds really mean.
Jason is working with White Wolf on V5 with me. So yes, don't worry, casual listeners. We don't have the stakes out for Jason. At least not in any serious
just for each
way.
Other.
Yeah, we'll gently poke him with the stakes. We won't run them through.
Oh, no.
Don't open the door.
Oh, no. We should have got out on cheesy wine, y'all. Like, we should have stopped.
So we're going out
wine.
on gently poking Jason Carl.
Oh no. Okay, well, thank you for listening to this very odd episode of Onyx Podcast. I'm Dixie Cochran. I was here with Eddie Webb and Matthew Dawkins. I don't even know what's happening anymore.
It's fine. So you can find us on social media if you
want.
Oh,
yeah, I forgot about that part.
Yeah, that's all right. You know, it's all gone to hell in a handbasket.
It's my first time hosting, and y'all just had to go all kinds of weird at the end.
I think we've gone all kinds of weird at the end.
Every episode so far.
Anyway, so Matthew, where can they find you on social media?
Do they want to? I guess
after this, I'm not sure.
I suppose if you're desperate to track me down, you can find me on Twitter under Clack Click Bang. You can find me on the Onyx Path forums under The Gentleman Gamer, and you can find me on YouTube as the Gentleman Gamer as well.
And Eddie,
you can find me at just about every social media site under Eddie Fate, EDDYFATE, or you can find me on my website eddiefate.com.
Awesome. You can find me on pretty much all social media at Dixie Cyanide. Dixie like my name, cyanide like the poison. I will keep saying that until someone quits asking me how to spell cyanide. Thank you for listening to the Onyx Podcast. We will be here in a couple weeks interviewing Ian Watson about Trinity and Exalted and all kinds of things he'll probably talk about for maybe more than an hour, because it's Ian and he really, really knows his stuff. So, as always, many worlds, one podcast.